Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the other podcasts over there. And while you're over there, go to the events page. We got events coming up. We're going to be in Houston. You know, when this releases, guys, I think if I'm on my game and I release this at the appropriate time, which doesn't always happen, but if it does happen this week, man, you got like hours to get over to St. Mark in Houston, Texas, because we are doing a city event there. And Chad will be there, and I'll be there, and Scott Keith, and Loso, and Gretchen Ronovic, and Big Matt Papa Vitz. So you should come on out to that. If you're listening to this, and Saturday, February 22nd, has not come and gone yet, come hang out with us in Houston, Texas. It's free. At that point, you probably don't need to register. You just show up, but no one's going to kick you out. Come hang out with us. Also, if you're, that date's come and gone, but you're like, I don't live in Texas anyway. I live in Nevada, or I live in Southern California. Well, we got you covered at a Las Vegas city event, March 21st. Now, unfortunately, Chad won't be there, but I'll be there. And, you know, I have some thoughts on the Old Testament, but we're not even going to be talking about the Old Testament. That's why we didn't bring Chad out. We're talking about Galatians, talking about how all that Old Testament stuff is done. But you can come and hang out. I'll be there. Eric Sorensen, Scott Keith, Cindy Koch, Blake Flatley, and Adam Francisco. We'd love to hang out with you. That's also free to sign up and show up. I will put a link in the show notes to all those events. If you are in Germany or Sweden, we will be there the first 2 weeks of May. We'd love to hang out with you at those events. Those are filling up. I will put links in the show notes to the websites where you can register. So, hey, our German listeners, our Swedish listeners, our listeners that are around those areas possibly that can travel. I don't know how this all works. Get on one of those fancy European trains. Get over to one of those places. We'd love to hang out with you. Link in the show notes. First 2 weeks of May, we'll be over there in Europe. Chad, how's it going, man?
It's going good. Yeah, I was just working on my... finishing up my presentation for Houston right before we started. So I am ready to go.
Nice.
All right.
Well, I have to do that later today.
Plenty of time.
We're good to go. All right, man. So we ended it kind of right in the middle of a story. I don't know if we'll finish this story this episode either, but this is one of the longer ones.
Yeah, we won't finish Gideon's story. I'm sure we'll finish this chapter and get into chapter 7. So we started Gideon last time, and we encountered him when he was kind of hiding out in a wine vat, getting some grain ready, and the angel shows up, and they have that kind of back and forth in which he's telling Gideon what he wants him to do. Gideon's coming up with all these Moses-like excuses why he can't do it. Anyway, in the end, the sacrifices offered by Gideon, the angel of the Lord, vanishes from his sight. And then Gideon is amazed that he's still alive. God says, chill, everything's going to be okay. Gideon builds an altar, names it Yahweh Shalom, the Lord is peace. And that's kind of where we left it. We finished there with verse 24 of Judges chapter 6. So, We're not skipping forward. We're going to pick up that same day, or rather that same night, and we're going to find out right away what the Lord is going to have Gideon do as his first task. It's a little bit different than some of the other judges, because a lot of the other judges, I mean, they're called and they go to war. They go to deliver Israel. But before Gideon does that, God seems to take his time with Gideon. There's a lot of like where you think you're going to go on right to the next sequence of actions, and everything's put on pause because God has to help Gideon along, or reassure Gideon, or tell him it's going to be okay, or let him hear a dream in which he is made a little bit braver because of his enemies. Anyway, there's a lot of kind of slowing down and speeding up in the story. So we're going to slow down here. Gideon's not going to march off to battle. Instead, first of all, he's got to take care of some stuff at home. Because as it turns out, as was probably pretty common with a lot of Israelites of the day, because of this increasing Canaanization that was taking place in Israel, his own dad has an altar, not an altar to Yahweh, but it's an altar to Baal. And as if that wasn't quite bad enough, there's also an Asherah pole that's right beside the altar. So Baal and Asherah, as we've talked about before, were probably worshipped as a couple quite frequently. Baal was kind of the, even though Baal wasn't like the head of the pantheon, he was like a junior god. He was the most popular god in the Canaanite culture, kind of the god of the skies and weather and storms and that kind of thing. Whereas Asherah was his consort. She was fertility goddess, as were many of the female divinities of this day. This Asherah pole, we hear about those all through the Old Testament. Chances are, if it was like a lot of the figurines that and stones that have been preserved and found by archaeologists, there would have been some sort of exaggerated sexual features on this pole. Exactly what that looked like, we don't know. But because she was a fertility goddess, that was often the way that they were depicted. So anyway, both of these, the altar to Baal and the Asherah pole, were right there on his dad's property. So picking up with verse 25, it says, that same night, so the same night after the day in which Gideon was called, God speaks to him, and he gives him these directions. It says, take your, a little confusing here, I'll explain it in a minute. It says, take your father's bull and a second bull, 7 years old, and pull down the altar of Baal, which belongs to your father, and cut down the Asherah that is beside it. So that's the first instruction. The second instruction follows that. So after doing that, verse 26, build an altar to the Lord your God on top of this stronghold in an orderly manner, and take a second bull and offer a burnt offering with the wood of the Asherah, which you shall cut down. So this is, well, first of all, this reminds me of a story that probably some of you are familiar with. I think it's from the 8th century. St. Boniface, he was a missionary, and he showed up in modern-day Germany, and he cut down this sacred oak. Remember the story? So he cuts down this sacred oak that was, you know, one of the pagan, belonged to one of the pagan gods, Thor, I think. Anyway, he cuts down this the sacred oak. And of course, everybody expects the god to like strike him down, but he doesn't. Just takes his axe, chops it down, and then uses some of the wood actually to build a chapel to Christ on the same spot.
I do not know this story, but this guy sounds like my kind of missionary.
Yeah. Cowardice he was never accused of cowardice. Let's put it that way. Yeah, it ended up being martyred later in his life. But yeah, kind of that's the most well-known story about Saint Boniface. I mean, it's kind of the same thing that Gideon is supposed to do here, because he's supposed to tear down the pagan worship site. And not only just tear it down, but he's actually to use the very wood of the Asherah pole to light the fire in which he's going to offer the sacrifice to God. So I mentioned before I started reading that, it was a little confusing. I can't get into the details because it's too technical with Hebrew, but it's a little confusing as to how we should translate that, because most of your English translations come across as if there's two bulls, right? It mentions your father's bull and then also this second bull that's 7 years old. The Hebrew can be translated possibly a couple different ways, to where this is actually like one bull that's 7 years old. We don't have to worry about that. But if you're wondering why the second bull, or you know, one of the bulls is never mentioned again, well, that could be just some confusion with translation. That being beside the point, he's going to use this bull or bulls to pull it down. You know, it's a full-grown 7-year-old bull is full-grown, pretty powerful. Going to use it to tear down the altar, and then the bull itself is going to be the sacrifice, and use the wood of the Asherah pole. All right, so. What's interesting, I mean, there's a lot of interesting things here, but I find it particularly interesting. The very next verse says that Gideon did this, but he kind of tweaked it a couple different ways. First of all, it says that he didn't do it by himself. That I think is fascinating. It says he took 10 men of his servants and did just as the Lord had spoken to him. Now, I mean, I don't guess there's anything wrong with that, but I do find it kind of interesting the more we find out about Gideon, kind of his personality, that he deals with fear a lot. He deals with hesitation. And so it's like he wants people to be around him when he's doing this. He doesn't want to do it alone. And the second thing that is perhaps even more telling is he did it by night because he was afraid of his father's household. Now, we're going to encounter Gideon's fear over and over again. We're going to see it, in fact, at the end of this chapter. We're going to encounter it one more time in chapter 7. So in that way, I guess he's not much different than some of the other people that God has called to do various tasks, whether it's fear or whether it's just doubt as to their abilities or whatever it might be. There's always an excuse that people can give. Now, in Gideon's case, God is very patient with him. He gives him sign after sign, promise after promise. And finally, it seemed to get through to Gideon. And in the end, when you get to chapter 7, he actually is able to see the success that God has given to him. So anyway, that's where we're at so far. Got the instructions to demolish and then to rebuild. And then it says Gideon did it. He took 10 of his servants and he did it by night. And then we get to verse 28.
Don't you think that this is something that's common between Gideon and then Barak, is this sort of, you get like a commissioned to do something. Gideon's case, right from God. In Barak's case, by God via Deborah.
Mm-hmm.
If there's one thing I empathize with, like maybe this is because like I don't like to do things all by myself, especially things like that. I completely empathize with that. Hey, I'm willing to do this. Can I take like some of my boys with me?
Yeah.
I mean, this right? I mean, like right, this is, right. I think this is pretty human nature. I mean, if I was like in war and I was like, they were like, hey, we want you to go on this mission. I'm like, can I take one person with me?
I have to do it by myself?
Just like, you know, you feel more like it kind of like firms up your steel, man, right? You're like, okay, right. We're doing this together. Like, you get by yourself, you start talking yourself into all kinds of crazy stuff. You start believing your doubts and all that stuff. You need, hey, man, it's not good for man to be alone. Even Jesus sent him out by twos. I understand the inclination to be like, I'll do it, but I need at least somebody going with me.
Yeah. Well, I completely understand that too. And you see in the other stories too, that most of the time that's what happens, right? Aaron ends up being, he's Moses' brother. He ends up causing sometimes more problems than he is helpful. And then, you know, and later in this story, he sends Gideon with his servant. And when you look at what a lot of the prophets went through, when they sort of stood alone against the world, and man, you can see just how the effect it had on them. You know, you read some of the things that Jeremiah wrote, man, that's some torturous stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, he feels just like completely beaten down. Everybody's against him. So standing by yourself or even doing this explicit commission from the Lord by yourself, that's pretty rough. It's a pretty rough vocation.
Yeah. I think it's even interesting. I think you see that desire to not be doing things by yourself throughout scripture. Now there's guys that have to do things alone. Ultimately this culminates in Christ who like does the ultimate work of God alone. But, you know, even Abraham's like, all right, I'm heading out. You know, this is sort of your first instant, like I'm heading out. Lot, come with me. Like he takes his nephew with him, you know, ends up being a huge pain in the neck. You know, he probably would have been better off not doing that. But yeah, you can just tell there's this desire that like, I don't want to do this all by myself. Like this is not what I want to do at all.
Yeah. In many ways, it's kind of our built-in human tendency. We're not like islands unto ourselves. We know the people. So God in his grace gives that.
Yeah. And I don't say like that to make any like deeply theological points other than like, hey, don't be too hard on Gideon for this part of it. Like I think most people would we've already seen it with Barak. I think most people would be like in that same state of mind where he is willing to do it at least. He's nervous about doing this by himself.
Right, right. You know what's fascinating is how his dad reacts to this too. So when the story goes on, it says everybody gets up in the morning and they see, you know, the Baal's altar is torn down, the Asherah is cut down, and the bull has been offered on the altar. And they're like, who did this, right? And so they like do this search, this inquiry, they're finding out, and somebody spills the beans and says, a Gideon, the son of Joash, did this. So they don't go straight to Gideon. They go to Joash, to his dad. Presumably, he was still living at home. We don't know his age. I don't know if we're ever told his age. Maybe later in the story. I can't remember. We don't know how old he is at this time, but he's still He's still living at home. And so they go to his father as the head of the extended family. And they say to him, bring out your son that he may die, because he's torn down the altar of Baal and he's cut down the Asherah, which was beside it. Now, just stop and think about that for a minute, because you got to catch the irony. Because these guys who are mad at Gideon for tearing down these idolatrous altars and poles, they are almost quoting verbatim the command that was given to Israel as to what was to be done to idolaters. So idolaters were to be killed. They were to be executed. Whereas these guys are wanting to execute Gideon because he destroyed their idolatrous fortifications and altars and poles. So, I mean, it's one of those kind of where everything is backwards in Judges. You know, you have Israelites worshiping the gods of the Canaanites, and you have them getting angry and wanting to put to death an Israelite who destroys their Canaanite worship sites.
Well, it lets you know how deep the idolatry has gone. I mean, this isn't just, yeah. We'll play nice. You know, we'll set up this thing over here and set up that. Man, we all know it doesn't mean anything. No, these guys are serious, right? Like, yeah. I mean, a grave sin has been committed here.
Yeah, or they weren't just like, well, yeah, I guess, you know, we shouldn't have been doing that. You know, Gideon was right. You know, we stand corrected. There's none of that. I mean, they're out for blood. Now, his dad's response is what I find most fascinating about this whole part of the story. Because, I mean, presumably, if Joash had built the altar, it belonged to him, and the Asherah, and I'm assuming that he offered sacrifices there too, then you would think that he would be angry, at least partially, with his son. But he turns things completely around. So Joash says to everybody who surrounded him and made these accusations and threats, he says, will you contend for Baal, or will you deliver him, or save him? Whoever will contend for him shall be put to death by morning. If he's a god, that is, if Baal's a god, let him contend for himself, because someone has torn down his altar. In other words, well, if Baal is such a good and powerful god, well, then let him defend himself, right? Somebody tore down his altar, so isn't Baal going to tear him down? So this Hebrew verb for that I have translated here as contend is often used in legal context. In fact, it kind of becomes later in the prophets, it becomes a form of an oracle, where it's kind of like this whole legal judgment scene that's set up between God and Israel. So here it has, sometimes it just means like contend, but this is more of kind of a legal framework. So if Baal needs to be his own defense attorney, basically, he needs to legally contend for himself. And then we have the same, that word for deliver is the same word that we see elsewhere for save, Yasha. So is he going to contend for himself? Is he going to save himself? What kind of God is he? So Joash just throws this right back in their face. I mean, without any hesitation, he doesn't kind of dilly-dally around about it, doesn't try and take two sides. He's fully in defense of his son. And presumably, he had some pretty powerful sway in the community. Otherwise, they would have said, get out of the way, we're getting him anyway. So I'm thinking that Joash was probably either the leader of this particular community, or at least pretty high up, just to be able, by those words alone, to stand behind his son.
This is the way you see a lot of people deal with when they're contending with gods. I mean, this is sort of a Elijah move, right? Where you sort of say, like, hey, let's find out what kind of God this is. I know when we got mixed up in some idolatry back in the day, like, the ground opened up and ate some of us. So, you know, like, let's see what happens. I mean, like, is this God so weak that he needs you to do something for him?
It reminds me of the story that we talked about way back in Genesis, when Jacob is heading back to his home country, and, you know, Rachel steals the household gods and sits on them while she's on her period. So it's like this double insult to the gods. You know, first she steals them, so these gods can't even keep themselves from being stolen, and then she sits on them, so they can't even get up, and then they're made unclean because she's on her period when all this is going on. So I mean, this is these are some of the ways in which you kind of have these built-in insults in the Old Testament against idolatry. I mean, if there's one thing that the Old Testament is not, in distinction from the way we tend to be today, I mean, we're very careful, right, about not offending someone's religious sensibilities, right? It's, you know, you gotta be respect of the people's religions and not say anything that's like sarcastic or derogatory. Well, when you get to the Old Testament, and I'm not saying that's wrong, but I'm saying if you compare that to the Old Testament, it's a whole different ballgame. I mean, they make up slanderous names against Baal, for instance. If somebody has a name that ends in Baal, very often they'll change it to Boshet, which means shame. So instead of Ish-Baal, it'll be Ish-Boshet. So instead of a son of Baal, it's a son of shame. You have that all over the Old Testament. And they make up all kinds of names to refer to these pagan deities. So this is one more instance of that. I mean, this is pretty tame compared to some of the other invectives against the false gods, but same thing is kind of going on here. You know, he's such an inept god. He can't even save himself. He can't even protect his own altar. So why in the world would we worship him when he's basically a weak and ineffectual god?
And you see how God, I mean, God knows that these other gods aren't real gods, obviously, but he's still like deeply offended by the worship mm-hmm. of these false gods. And you see him like do that sort of thing all over. So what does he want you to do? Oh, I want you to cut that down, and I want you to burn it, and then like build another thing to me on top of it. He's at war with this non-god. But this happens all over. I mean, it's like we talked about this in the episode with the golden calf, where it's like melt it down, grind it up, drink it. Man, this is deeply personal. Like, he's going to show you just how lousy your God is. One of my favorites is when they put the Ark of the Covenant in the same space as Dagon, and like this, like God's just like smacking this idol around all night, right. Breaking his hands off and stuff.
Yeah. This carries over to the New Testament as well. You know, when Jesus cast the swine, the demons into the swine, and they run off the cliff. Mm-hmm. So I mean, this contention between basically this war between heaven and hell that's already going on in the Old Testament continues into the New Testament. And I think the reason is, you know, Deuteronomy talks about this, and then Paul talks about it in 1 Corinthians, that that all these false gods, yeah, they're not gods, of course, but they are basically the mask of demons. Mm-hmm. That's the real threat here. So anytime that God is declaring war against gods or insulting gods or anything like that, this is his way of either having a physical or spiritual or verbal war against the forces of evil.
Yeah.
So this is just kind of a part of that bigger story.
Another one of those great stories is like when Moses throws down the staff and it becomes a snake. These other guys are like, no problem, we got this, and they throw down their staffs.
Yeah, we can do
that. And there's all these snakes now, and then Moses snake eats them all.
Yeah. All right. It's really rather humorous.
Yeah, God, he is all about that kind of stuff, man. He's not like sitting there, the Ark of the Covenant sitting there with Dagon. He's like, well, I mean, I don't want to offend anybody.
Right, yeah. Yeah, he's smacking on these false gods left and right. Okay, so anyway, that basically takes us through that story. The only part that's to sum it up is it says on that day that Gideon's father nicknamed him, most likely. He called him Jerub Baal or Yeruv Baal, which means it's taken the name of Baal, and it's joining that verb about contending to it. So let Baal contend against him. So he's got a good nickname now, right? He's like a god destroyer. So that takes us to the end of that particular part of this chapter. Picking up with 33, it says that the Midianites and the Amalekites and the sons of the east that we met at the very beginning of this chapter, so these enemies of Israel who are going in and devouring the land, they assembled again, they crossed over, and they camped in the Valley of Jezreel. Jezreel is a very fertile place in Israel. We hear a lot about this Valley of Jezreel throughout the Old Testament. So they go there, they set up their tents, and presumably they're there to do exactly what they've been doing over the past few years. They bring their camels, and they devour everything, they steal, they take whatever they want, and basically rape the land. So what happens? Verse 34 says that the Spirit of the Lord came upon Gideon. I mean, I want to correct that translation. I notice, I think ESV does that too, that that the Spirit of the Lord came upon Gideon. The Hebrew there is actually clothed, which is kind of a stronger word. I mean, a lot of times we have the Spirit coming upon some person, but I don't know, maybe I just like the metaphor better, but the idea of the Spirit clothing him connotes more of how he is completely enveloping him to use him in the service of delivering Israel. So anyway, the Spirit of the Lord clothes Gideon. He blows a trumpet, and the Abiezrites, that's his clan, were called together to follow him. So this is kind of strange. I mean, this is unexpected because they were just trying to kill him before, right? They came, this is his clan, so they come to his dad, Joash, we want to execute Gideon. And now everything's changed. So maybe it's just the work of the Spirit. I don't know what went on, but the very man that they wanted to kill before, now the Spirit clothes him, he blows a trumpet, and they're like, gung-ho. So whatever happened, they're following him now.
Well, apparently this argument that his dad made held up pretty well. They're like, oh, all right, I guess we'll see if anything happens to this guy. Nothing happens. And they're like, oh, okay, I guess.
Okay, yeah. It was convincing, right?
I guess. That they went along with the wait-and-see approach, and nothing happened. So they're like, I guess this guy is a God destroyer.
Yeah, must be. So we'll be on his side. And not only them, but it says that he sent messengers through Manasseh and to Asher and Zebulun and Naphtali. So all of the tribes that were in that particular area. And of course, they would have been the ones who were suffering the most from the invasion of these Midianites. So he sends messengers to gather them together. Now, at this point, you would think that the very next sequence of events would be Gideon gathers his soldiers and they prepare to attack. But not yet. First of all, we have to deal with fleece. So beginning with verse 36 and going through 40, we have Gideon's hesitation once more. This is another one of those kind of fast forward, slow down, fast forward, slow down moments in Gideon's story. So Gideon says to God, if you will truly deliver Israel through me as you have spoken, then here's what I want you to do. I'm going to put this fleece of wool on the threshing floor. And if there's dew on the ground, I mean, if there's dew on the fleece only, and it's dry on the ground, then I will know that you will deliver Israel through me as you have spoken. And that's what happened, right? So he gets up early and he squeezes the fleece. He drains the dew from the fleece and he gets a whole bowl full of water. All right. You'd think that'd be good enough, but no. Then Gideon says to God, don't get mad at me, but I want to do one more thing. Let me make a test once more with the fleece. Let it now be dry only on the fleece, but let it be wet everywhere else. And once more, God did that. It was dry on the fleece and the dew was all over the ground. You were saying earlier, you begin to believe your own doubts. And I think that's kind of what's going on with it. You know, everything went well with the altar of Baal, turn that down. And he's clothed with the Spirit now. And all these people are gathered around him, but he's still struggling with these doubts. Now, what's interesting about this is that this is the only time, I think, this is the only time when someone tests God in the Old Testament and there's not a negative repercussion as a result of it. This is the same word that's used, the same verb that's used for when the Israelites were at Massah and Meribah. So Massah means testing, and the root of that word is the same word, verbal root that's used here. So most of the time when you test God, things do not go well with you, but God is patient with Gideon and works things out. By the way, do people still say, like, if they're trying to make a decision, oh, I'm going to put out some fleece?
Yeah. I've heard this before. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, if you say that, please stop.
Yeah.
Because if you're listening along and you know this story and you know what Gideon is doing, then you know that that's not like some example that's held up, which is a good example to follow.
Yeah. And I think that the reason why God goes along with this, and so often in other instances he does not go along with it, and this is maybe most notably true in the life of Jesus, where they're over and over and over again you read, and then they put him to the test saying this, or mm-hmm. they'll say we need to see a sign, Like, right? So this happens all the time in the life of Christ, and he never goes along with it.
Right.
I mean, he's whenever someone's like, show us a sign, he's like, he always has some like scorching rebuke. Because it's usually like he'll like feed 5,000 people, and then they'll be like, we need to see a sign. And he's like, I can
sense, is that all you can do?
Yeah, I understand the frustration here. But when people in the life of Christ and other places in the Old Testament, when they're putting God to the test, they are not putting God to the test out of sincere doubt. In other words, in a wanting to believe but struggling. In the case in the life of Christ, you see over and over again, this is always to try to trap him, to try to show that he's not who he is. It's a malicious. It's a testing whose end goal is not to affirm what God is doing, but to try to disprove or discount what God is doing. And so I think that that's maybe part of it, is that Gideon's a dude that's struggling. He's questioning himself. Like, am I really hearing from God? I don't know what's going on. It's not that he doesn't have a desire to say that it's not God or that he shouldn't do these things. I think this is just sort of a sincere doubt. And that, it seems like God has more patience for than, well, I'm going to test him, or I'm going to trick him, or I'm going to try to trap him, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I really do think this is a case where God understands where the person is coming from. And maybe we can't always see that, but he does. So, you know, Gideon wants to believe. He wants to remove his doubts. He wants to be completely sure. And so God kind of plays along with it and gives him these particular signs. Okay, chapter 7. We'll jump right into another pretty well-known part of the story of Gideon. And this is the narrowing down of his armed forces. So it starts out by kind of giving him both his names. It says, now Yerub-Baal, that is Gideon, so his nickname and his real name, and all the people who were with him, they go up to camp at this place called the Spring of Harod, H-A-R-O-D. Now, I'll point out now, because it's significant in a minute, that Hebrew word, which is translated here as a proper noun, Harod, it comes from the word for trembling. So kind of keep that in mind. So this is the Spring of Trembling. So they camp there, and on the other side was the camp of Midian. So they were by the hill of Moreh, which, by the way, is close to at the foot of the hill called Moreh is where Nain is at, which comes up in the Gospels, right? That's where Jesus raises the widow's son. So Nain is, even the modern day city of Nain is located kind of on the slopes of the hill of Moreh. So anyway, that's where they're at. They're by the spring, by the hill of Moreh. And God just gave these signs to Gideon, right, to make sure that he was okay with this. Well, now God is about to make things more difficult for him. He says, look, all these guys that you have with you, there's too many. There's way too many for me to give Midian into your hands, because I know what's going to happen. Because with all these people, if you go and you defeat them, here's what Israel's going to say. My own power has delivered me. So what does God do? He says, well, we're gonna start to drastically reduce your forces. First of all, I want you to go out and tell everyone, whoever's afraid and trembling, there's your word. So they camped at the Spring of Trembling, the Spring of Herod, same word that's used here in verse 3. So whoever's afraid and trembling, like the Spring of Trembling, let him go home. So let him return. And I mean, these guys volunteered for this, but there must have been a whole bunch of trembling and fear going on, because there were 32,000 when they started out, and 22,000 of those people went back home. So now Gideon's forces are reduced to less than a third of what he had before. Now you would think at this point, God would be like, okay, I'm gonna still give you 10,000 people, but he's not done. Verse 4, then God says to Gideon, oh, too many people still. Bring them down to the water, and I'm going to test them. Actually, the Hebrew there is refine them. This is not the same word for testing that we just talked about back in chapter 6. This is a word that's it's a metallurgical word for removing the dross from metal. So this is God's process of refining the troops. So I will refine them there for you. And whoever I say, this one shall go with you, he's going to go. And whoever says, this one shall not, he won't. So he brings him down to the water. And the Lord says to Gideon, you shall separate everyone who laps the water with his tongue as a dog laps, as well as everyone who kneels to drink. So I, you know, some kind of system they came up with, they watched him. And the only people who put water in their hand and lapped the water were 300. Everybody else kneeled down to drink out of the water. And so God says to Gideon, I will deliver you with the 300 men who lapped and will give the Midianites into your hands. So let all the other people go, each to his home. Now, if I were Gideon at this point, I would definitely be getting nervous.
Well, this is what a weird test, right? I mean,
it is a really strange test. Yeah.
Now I've heard sermons where people try to explain this, like the practicality of it. They're like, well, see, because if you took water in your hand and lapped it, you still have your eyes up, so you could see.
Yes.
You
know what I mean?
This kind of, yes. And you're like, no, dude. This is just more evidence that God is a weirdo. God does weird stuff, man.
That is all this is. Yeah.
Because there's no, like, I'm going to get you the best 300 guys that really know how to fight. Like, do you know how this battle goes? Like, it doesn't matter who the 300 are. He's just trying to reduce it down to not very many guys.
Yeah, these aren't like the 300 Spartans.
Yeah.
These are like 300, and they're not like professional soldiers, right? They're probably farmers. And yeah, they have some battle experience, but it's not like we're dealing with, you know, 300 members of the Israelite special forces or something.
I'm surprised 300 guys drink water this way. Who drinks water like that?
That's probably why he said that, right? Because he knew the numbers would be so low.
Yeah, you're like, that's what I'm saying. I don't think there's anything practical about it than other than, like, if you have 300 guys that drink water in a very weird, like a dog, what? Like, nobody drinks water that way.
Yeah, I think this is nothing more than God choosing something that's going to get a low number. I wouldn't allegorize this. No. I don't think it has anything to do whatsoever with their fitness for battle.
I understand scooping water up with your hands and then, like, drinking it. But this is talking about scooping water up with your hands and then lapping it out with your tongue. Who does this? Apparently 300 out of 10,000.
Yeah, 300 out of 10,000 did it. So that's where we're going to have to leave Gideon. I mean, this is all a setup, by the way. It's kind of like you said earlier, this is just weird. Well, this is the way God works. He works in really weird ways. He always works in ways that you wouldn't expect, that no military planner would put a stamp of approval on. Everything that he does here is backwards to what we'd expect. But the whole point is what he said earlier. I want to make sure, I mean, I'm going to make it so patently obvious that I'm the one who gives this victory, that I will go to ludicrous extremes in order to make sure that nobody in his right mind would have gone about it this way, and nobody in the right mind would believe that it was because of the military prowess of these 300 guys that Israel's victory was secured. It's going to be me alone.
No, God's going to say, like, here's how I'll make sure of it. It's going to be you and 300 guys that don't know how to drink water correctly. That's how I'm going to do it. Look, these guys can't even drink water correctly. So obviously this is going to be my work.
Right, right. Yeah, and to wrap it up with this, this is really one more example we have throughout the Old Testament of what we call the theology of the cross, right?
Yeah.
Where God is working not the way that we expect. So he's choosing things which are foolish, things which are weird, things which are upside down and backwards, and just not the way the world works. In other words, well, that's just happens to be the way that God likes to work, in order that it might be clear that it's by his word and power alone that the deliverance of his people is accomplished. So this all basically is the background to the cross. And the cross is what infuses all of this with an understanding as to how God chooses to work among us.
Yeah, and that is it, man. We're going to leave Gideon and his 300 dog guys there, and we're going to come back and see what happens next week. Guys, if you'd like to support the podcast, you can do so by going over to 1517, go to the donate page where you can become a contributor. Thank you so much to those of you who do that. You make all of this possible. Chad, I'll see you next week.
All right. See you.